the tragedy was compounded afterwards by the fact that we had mentioned many people died and many Jews died in the accident as well. And there's one tragic case which you may have heard of an individual who called his family, called his friend from, I believe he was above where the plane hit in Tower Number 1, a man whose name was Shimi Beagleisen, who called his friend, and the accounts are different, and it's not so important, but just the tragedy and the presence of mind makes us all give pause to think, and called his rabbi to discuss some of the issues with his rabbi. Imagine this. And I said, I don't attest to the actual veracity or not, but the issues, it's clear that a conversation took place discussing these very issues. What should he do in this particular circumstance to prevent his wife from becoming an aguna? Now, what is an aguna? Let's just pause for a moment and define the issue of aguna. In Jewish law, if a husband disappears, or we know, I'm not addressing the also tragic circumstance of the husband who refuses to give a divorce, a writ of divorce, a get to his wife, which is a very controversial and very, very important issue in a Jewish community. But if a person disappears and it is unknown what his whereabouts are, that woman cannot remarry unless evidence is brought that the husband clearly died. So there are stories, whether it's this individual or others, of people asking the following question, and horrible just even to think about. Should I, standing here in the tower, should I do something so that it is clear to everybody that I died in this accident? And the question was asked, should I jump out the window because maybe somebody will see me and there will be testimony to the fact that I died? Because the law is, and this is part of the complex legal issue, that in the absence of evidence or testimony that the husband is in fact dead, the woman cannot remarry ever. And there's some, perhaps he may even faxed a writ of divorce, a get, to his wife. And this is one particular circumstance where you have one individual, there are others who didn't have that presence of mind, others who perished in the tragedy. What is to be of their wives, of their remaining relatives? The Beis Din of America and the Rabbinic Council of America are now considering, I believe, 7 or 8 cases of potential agunot of women who lost their husbands in the World Trade Center that need legal clarification if they are to remain in aguna for the rest of their lives or if they can potentially remarry. They're Matir 5 already. So Baruch Hashem, they are Matir 5, which means that based on whatever evidence they had, and this is part of the halachic discussion, they allowed 5 of these women to remarry. So the halachas are very, very complex, and I don't profess, I'm sure Dr. Steinberg will elaborate on this, but the issues to raise in this particular setting are, what is considered significant evidence to determine the status? Now there is testimonial evidence. And the halacha is that with respect to aguna, you can accept testimony which is far less rigorous than the normal requires evidential requirements of testimony. You don't need to have 2 witnesses. You can have 1 witness. You can have a woman. You can have a non-Jew can even have some part of testimony. And also, more importantly, can you use the DNA evidence if they just obtain DNA and nothing else? And if you don't have any evidence whatsoever, that the person, any physical evidence or any physical testimony of the individual, how does one deal with that? So I'll turn it over to Dr. Steinberg to elaborate.
As usual, an excellent and very eloquent and comprehensive presentation, and I doubt that I have much to add, but since I have a job to add something, I'll try to do it. Let me start with the first issue, and this is the question of how much risk one should take in order to save others. I'll start with the end. The end is, there is a paragraph in Aruch HaShulchan, I don't know if it's in this handout, I didn't have a chance to read the whole outline. But Aruch HaShulchan says the following, it is true that v'nishmartem me'od l'nafshoteichem is a halachic rule. You have to keep good health of yourself. But don't exaggerate with it. Don't be too machmir about yourself. If you are in a situation that you can save others' life, don't make the exact calculation that perhaps it's already 50.1% risk and therefore I shouldn't enter and a person will die. It is better to take some risks and save lives. And I think that is a very important lesson to everyone, but it is certainly an important lesson for healthcare providers. We never know the exact risks. I mean, even the second tower, which you assume that if the first one collapsed, the second one had a greater risk to collapse, how much risk was it at a time, before you entered the building, before it collapsed? Was it over 50%? Was it less than 50%? How many people could you save at that time? So making all these calculations becomes an issue which is very individual, and there are no strict rules about it. I don't think that anyone can make very firm rules and draw a guideline or a protocol and say, in this instance you do, in this instance you don't. You have to evaluate each case by itself, remembering the Aruch HaShulchan, that you have to be more lenient in saving life than being machmir on v'nishmartem me'od l'nafshoteichem. Certainly, if you are a healthcare provider, and as Dr. Eichmann elaborated upon it, and the tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer, and Eliashiv, and Rav Zilberstein, all of them saying that it is a separate category of a healthcare provider to do more than anyone else as far as lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, or v'ashevot alo, or whatever source, halachic source it is to save life. So indeed, if the risk is enormous and clear and you know that this is the risk, then you can refrain, or you should refrain, depends on the various shittes. But the calculation is never a mathematical calculation. You never know exactly what the situation is, and therefore be more lenient in saving life. That, I think, is a rule of thumb that most people do. I mean, Hatzola people and medics in the army and medics in disasters that happen in terrorist attacks and so on, all are doing it all the time, and I don't think they're doing something against halacha. Second comment regards to the equation, whether there is such, between a situation of war, a situation of disaster, and a regular set of situations. According to Rav Kook, and he has a lengthy discussion concerning the laws of war are a separate category as far as saving life is concerned, or endangering is concerned. By the mere fact that war is permissible, whether it's Milchemet Reshut or Milchemet Mitzvah, but once you go into war, it is a permissible act. There's a whole chapter in Kitavo, that you talk about how do you go into war. Every war is an enormous endangerment. I can't be a soldier, and when the officer tells me, you go over there, I'll take out a tzetelen, I'll say, v'nishmartem me'od l'nafshoteichem, I don't go there. So obviously, you can't conduct a war that way. So if a war would have been a priori forbidden, then you would say, yes, you can't endanger your life, even in a setup of war. But since war is permissible, under whatever conditions, but it is permissible, the mere situation of a war is a great endangerment, usually beyond the statistical dangers that the Radbaz is talking about on a regular basis in regular situations. Therefore, the laws of war are totally different than laws of any other situation where one has to endanger himself in order to save life. Therefore, it seems to me very clear, without going into all the discussions about a medic at war or a physician at war, that his obligations at war are like the obligations of a soldier. And like the soldier has endangered himself going into the fire, so is the obligation of the medic or the physician to endanger his life in order to save the life of this soldier as part of the laws of war, but not as part of a regular lota modal damrecha. This is, I think, what comes clear from a whole host of tshuvas of Harav Kook, and I think it makes a lot of sense from a logical point of view. A third comment, so now the question is a disaster situation similar to a war situation, or is a disaster situation similar to a regular situation just multiplied with casualties? But really, it is not a situation of war. And to the best of my knowledge, most poskim differentiate between war and disaster. Disaster is a one-time occurrence that happened. No one wanted it. No one is willing for it to happen. But now it's there. And by the way, it's not only September 11. I mean, such disasters, even in similar proportions, happen with earthquakes, with floods. There are hundreds of people that are injured and dying, and the situation is very dangerous to enter into the area in order to save people. These are questions that come up again and again, not necessarily in the setup of September 11, although it had its unique aspects from this point of view. So I think that most of the poskim that I am aware of say that in order to save someone at an earthquake tragedy or September 11 tragedy will not be the same as a war situation. Because as correctly pointed out by Dr. Rachman, the war situation has a reasoning behind it, has a rationale behind it. The soldiers that go and endanger themselves want to be assured that if something happens to them, they will be rescued. And if they are not assured, obviously their way of fighting will be different. But in a disaster situation, no one wanted it, and no one wants it from now on, and therefore there's nothing to decrease a morale or to enhance morale as far as the people that are in danger there. They weren't sent there, they don't have a role there, they just have to save their lives, and therefore it's really a different set of situations. What was not discussed regarding saving mass casualties are the questions of priorities. Who do you save? Who do you save first? How do you act in order to saving in disastrous situations? Let me just briefly comment on that, because I think there is a whole host of issues that come up in disastrous situations. There was a situation in Lebanon when Israel was fighting within Lebanon in the town of Tzor in south of Lebanon. There was a group of soldiers that were in a building, and a terrorist has bombed the building and the building collapsed. In a small scale, September 11, the building collapsed, and there were a lot of soldiers trapped in the building. What was known when the rescue teams came was that in the higher floors, there were few soldiers. Most of the soldiers were in the lower floors when the building collapsed. It was clear that if the rescue team will gradually take away the debris and save the people from up, down, by the time they'll get to the bottom, no one will be alive, because it will take a long time. On the other hand, in order to reach the large group which were in the bottom part of the building, they will need to remove quickly the upper part, including people who are there, who still may be alive, and by removing them with machineries, they will be killed. So what do you do in such a situation? Do you save the first that you encounter, which is the minority as far as numbers are concerned, and you sacrifice knowingly a large majority of soldiers, or do you kill, or at least not save, a minority group in order to get to the majority and save more lives? That was a real question in Tsar, and I assume similar situations happened in the Twin Towers, where the building collapsed and perhaps there were more people down than up, and maybe some people fell down, and the situation could have been a very similar situation. I don't know if there was knowledge about it, but in Tsar's situation, this was a fact known before the rescue team started working. And there was, like usually, a machlokes between two of the prominent poskim in Israel, what should have been the right thing to do. By the way, to the best of my knowledge, they decided to remove the upper part quickly, even though they were killing a few people, in order to get to the bottom quickly and save many people. Rav Zilberstein ruled that this was the right thing to do. In a situation where you are intending to save many, even though on the way you are killing few, that is not considered killing. This is considered part of rescuing. That is part of the Hatzalah. Whereas the Rabbi Israeli said, killing is killing, no matter what your intentions are. And if you come with a bulldozer and you go on top of a person in order to get to many others, that is killing. You can't do it. So you have to save him, and then whatever is left, save at the bottom. The exact sources of their machlokes are not very clear. It's a lot of personal thinking. But there is a chazonish, a very interesting chazonish, that discusses the following situation. He frames it, if an arrow is shot in the air, and the direction of this arrow is towards a group where there are many people, are you allowed to divert this arrow, if you can force it, to go to a different direction so that you'll save the group of many people, but in the new direction there's one person that will get hit? So by your action, you are saving many, but you are killing one. If you would do nothing, this one was never intended to die, because the arrow was never intended to go to him. The arrow was intended to go to the many. Now, the true story, it's not an arrow story, it was a real story, and I knew the person who asked the shaile. It was a driver who lost his brakes of the car when he was going down the hill of the Carmel Mount in Haifa. And he saw, he would go straight wherever the car would go. And he saw that at the end of the road, there was a group of many people. He still could maneuver the wheel. So he could move the car to another direction, save these many people, but he saw that in the only direction that he could move it, there was one person. And his dilemma was, should he save these many people from dying by diverting the car to the one that was not intended to die? But he is going to save the many. So this was the question posed to the Chazon Ish. There was a similar question posed to Rav Zilberstein at the time of the Gulf War. As you know, our good friend Saddam Hussein has sent missiles to Tel Aviv. And the direction of the missiles was such that if it would fall in Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv was crowded with many people will die. So what did our other friend do, the Americans? They sent us the Patriots, which were intercepting with this missile and letting it down before it reaches Tel Aviv. But if it hits this missile in the air, it may fall in Hulon. And people in Hulon, although less crowded and less people, they will die because it will fall on them. How do you know that it will not fall on Tel Aviv and fall in the desert? That would be the best, but you can't tell it. So there was a FUM officer, an American, in the Patriot group that was sent from America, that went to Avzal Silberstein and asked him this shaila: am I allowed to shoot my anti-missile weapon to intercept with this missile and perhaps kill someone who is not intended to die, although I know that I'll save many more lives? So Avzal Silberstein told him he should do it, based on the Chazon Ish with the arrow, which the Chazon Ish said that the right thing would have been to turn the wheel or to turn the arrow towards the one. Why? Because the intention is to save the many. The fact that someone else dies, if it is a minority, you are not intending to kill it, so if you can save many and not save few, it is better to save the many rather than the few. But if you look in the Chazon Ish, he didn't conclude it in such a terms as I am saying it. He says, Nir'eli, kanir'eh. I'm not sure that he was sure about his decision. Whereas Rav Silberstein took it as a psak and converted it into the situation that he was asked about, and I'm not sure what the right halacha would be here. So, coming back to such disasters where you can save a few or many, so obviously if the few are here and the many are here and you have an option either to go here or to go there, obviously you go to the many. That is an easy question. But if in order to save the many you have to sacrifice the few, and not only sacrifice by not tending to them, but by actually killing them, what is the preferred action that you should take? So as I said, that's a machloikes between Rabbi Silberstein and Rabbi Israeli, and I think that it is a lot of personal, emotional aspects rather than true halachic psak, because I don't know any sources that deal directly with such tragic decisions. What is better discussed in halacha is that if you have before you many wounded, and you are a small group of healthcare providers, who do you treat first? And obviously, your decision who to treat first will be very significant who will survive and who will not. Because the ones that you are treating first may have a chance to survive, but that time is lost for others who may not make it until you get to them. So how do you deal with what is called in ethical terminology, triage decision? Who do you choose first? So already in Napoleon times, his surgeons have established their triage decision making, which was start with those who are wounded in a way that they are not very seriously wounded, but also not very lightly wounded. In our terminology, it would mean start with those that need attention, otherwise they will die, but the attention needed is short and you can finish it quickly. So for instance, if you have, for the sake of clarity, you have three wounded people. One has a little blood running out of his hand. The other one can't breathe. And the third one has massive bleeding. So you should start with the one that has a massive bleeding, put something in order to stop his bleeding. With this, you saved his life. If you won't do it, he'll bleed to death. But you don't need to attend to him anymore. If you will start with the one who is not bleeding and you will start pumping, you'll have to sit with him all the time. And then all the rest will die. So therefore, don't treat those that need the treatment but need all your time. And obviously don't treat those that can wait and nothing will happen to them although they are somewhat injured. But treat those that if you won't treat them will die, but your treatment can be quick and save their lives. This is how armies operate today, and this is substantiated by all the poskim that dealt with it. Rav Zilberstein, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Waldenberg, all have agreed that this is the preferred way in order to do it. How practically do you do it? Unfortunately, we have a lot of experience now in hospitals where many are coming after terrorist attacks and we have many wounded at once, and there are ways on to decide who to treat first, who to treat later, but the principle is the one that I have said. Obviously, if you have enough manpower and enough room to treat everyone, you treat everyone. There was another interesting instance which Rav Eliashiv was asked about, and this was the following. A group of soldiers went into one of the villages in order to fight there, and they were accompanied by a physician and a medic. And usually the physicians, the army physicians, go with the soldiers wherever they go, and there is also a group of physicians who stay back and they receive the wounded and give them better treatment, not under fire. But there is always one physician who goes into wherever the soldiers go in order to give immediate treatment whoever will be wounded. On the way, before even reaching the destiny, one of the soldiers was severely wounded, to the degree that he needed a tracheostomy in order to save his life, and the physician on the spot, under fire, did what he had to do, and now he had to evacuate him back in order to save his life. He couldn't go further on. But this soldier needed attention all the time. Even if you put him on the helicopter, someone has to beg him in order to give him a way to breathe. So the question of the physician was, should he go with this soldier back and the rest of the group will be left without a physician, reasoning that this is a chole befaneinu. This is already someone who needs medical attention. The others are all healthy at the moment. They might be injured when they go further in, but at the moment they are healthy. So his obligation is right now to this particular patient. Or, because this group is highly liable to have people severely injured and they'll need medical attention, and adding the rationale that we discussed before, that the morale of a soldier is dependent on the fact that he knows that someone is there to help him if he gets wounded. If this group of soldiers will know that they have no physician with them, and they know that they will get wounded, they probably will not fight the same way as they would if they know that someone can help them right away. A very tragic decision, because this particular soldier wounded may die on the way if someone experienced will not take care of him, whereas the other soldiers may not fight well if they don't have the physician with them, and there's only one physician. So Rav Eliashiv ruled that the physician should stay with the group, because the laws of war are different than any other laws. And therefore, the idea that this group has to fight and they are liable to be injured and they need someone to help them is more important than this particular wounded patient. You could argue, obviously, in many directions, but I'm telling you what Rav Eliashiv's position was. So these are some, obviously, of the issues that come up when mass disaster occur in various situations, in war and in other disasters. There's one point that I would like to add to this, and this is that halachically, and I think it's now accepted even ethically, you have an obligation to save first someone who is important for others before you save someone who is only important to himself. In other words, in an army situation, an officer has a priority to be saved compared to a regular soldier. Because the idea is that if you save the soldier, you save his life. If you save the officer, he can continue fighting and ordering the fight and really save many. So saving his life is more than saving his own life, is saving many more lives. There's a Rashi in Horaios that really points to this direction that Kohen Mashuach Milchama has priority over other Kohanim because he is the one that takes the army and inspires them and so on, and therefore he has priority. So that's another point of priorities with this tragic situations. I think time is running short. Let me just very briefly comment on the Aguna situation. I don't know the answers to it. I know that Rav Eliashiv was very much involved in the DNA situation. I think he did accept the DNA for Aguna purposes. There's a major debate now how reliable the DNA is in order to identify a person as such. Although logically, it really doesn't make much sense. Two Edim who testify something is considered 100% proof. Although we all know that two Edim can lie. And it can be not true. Yet, Al Pi Shnayim Edim Yakum Davar. That's what the Torah has taught us. DNA can make a mistake. But the mistake of DNA, if you do it correctly and so on, is, I don't know, 99% of reliability. So for 0.5% mistake, you wouldn't accept a DNA. I would assume that the trust that you can give into two Edim is not much greater than that. Yet, it's Gzeras HaKosuf. That's how the Torah told us. The Torah told us, Al Pi Shnayim Edim Yakum Davar, even if it doesn't make sense to us, even if it's not 100% assurance, that is how halacha is established. You come now with a tool that we don't know what it is, it's something new. If it's not 100%, we won't use it for everything. So for instance, if by DNA testing, you can prove that this particular child is not the child of the husband of the woman. And you know it, 99.9%, that this child couldn't be the child of the husband of the woman. But if two Edim would come and say it, this child would be a mamzer, right? If you test it by DNA, he's not a mamzer. We don't believe the DNA to that degree. For other instances, less severe than that, most poskim have accepted. For instance, if the husband says, this is not my child and I don't want to pay mezoinos. It's a money matter. I have to pay for the child, but I don't believe this is my child. And you're doing DNA testing and indeed it's not his child. So some of the poskim say he doesn't have to pay for the child because that's reliable enough to say that he is not the father. But to make it as reliable as two Edim, that's not. So on the Aguna situation, where even one ed is enough to be matir, v'aguna hekelu rabonon, Chazal made it easier because of the tragedy of a woman not being able to marry, and some of the regular halachas do not apply. There are poskim who say that for that matter, DNA would be enough. it wouldn't be like two Edim, but at least it's like Ed Echad. And if Ed Echad is enough, DNA should be enough as well. So this is some of the post-Kim's argument. There's another very interesting issue in general of Aguna. World War I was very famous for many, many Agunas, because the way the war was conducted then, where it was a static war for many years, one against the other in some kinds of holes in the earth, and if someone didn't come back, who knows if he's alive and went somewhere else and found another woman, and he's still alive somewhere. There was no way really to know what's going on. And therefore there were a lot of shilas of Aguna and very difficult ones. World War II was already a little different. Because if there was evidence that someone was in a concentration camp, even if you don't know direct evidence that he was perished there, many of the poskim assumed that in this difficult situation, you can assume that he perished. Not all, but some would say it. Now, what is the concept that is used usually in Aguna? The concept is used Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. If someone falls into waters that you don't see the end of it, even if someone testifies that he saw him falling into the ocean, the woman will not be permitted to remarry because you didn't see the end of the water. Maybe he swam, went out of the other side, and he is making good life somewhere else in the world. Today, the assumption is that there is no more Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. Communication is so developed that if he is alive, someone would have communicated it and someone would have known about it, not like in the old world when someone went to the other side of the ocean and he disappeared. No one would know about him. Today, it's very hard to disappear in the world. That's one assumption. Now, the Twin Tower situation was unique in the fact that it is like Mayim She'esh Lahem Sof, because this is a building. And whoever was in the building and you didn't see him coming out of the building must have died in the building. There's no other way. So if you have evidence that he was in the building, that can be already by itself a lenient approach to say that he probably died. So some of the poskim, again, I'm not saying any psak, I'm just giving you some of the ideas running around. If someone with a cellular phone called someone else and said, I'm in the building, and then you never heard about him, then it should be enough to say that he died in this building, because you know he was there, and it's Mayim She'esh Lahem Sof. If he would come out, you would have seen him. And if you don't see him, therefore he died. If you don't know if he was in the building, although you assume he was in the building, let's say he went out from home in order to go to his office in the Twin Towers, and you never heard from him. Did he come to the Twin Towers? Was he there? Or did he go somewhere else? Then there's a Shiloh of Aguna, because you don't know if he was there to begin with. But if you know that he was there, some would say that by itself is enough, even if you don't have clear evidence that he died, and therefore there was no need to jump from the roof in order to show myself that I am there, enough that you called and you said you are there. So this is another aspect that is unique to this particular situation. I know that some of the poskim are using these arguments in order to help out with some of the aguna situations, and I think therefore there are quite few instances that are still agunas, that are still debatable, because many of those who were there, and we know that they were there, or the remains were found by DNA, most of the poskim I think would accept that their wives can remarry, and there are only those few that we don't know that the husbands were there, nothing was found of them, and we don't know where they are. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We're not going to take any questions. It's already late. Afterwards, you can take questions. Unfortunately, Dr. Reichman, I want to wish him a good trip back. He arrived about 2.5 hours ago. His plane leaves in an hour and a half. So I wanted to wish him a good trip, and thank you. We'll take a 3-minute break, and Dr. Herman is here. I saw him before. I don't know where he's floating around, but I assume he's here. And we appreciate Achron Achron Chaviv. It's always hard to be the last speaker at the end. Please give him your attention. Stay, and then we'll see you later. 8 o'clock.